Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan Compass came from thee. Jesus saved.
Welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Dan Dodgen, who is the Division Director for the Division for At-Risk Individuals, Behavioral Health, and Community Resilience. It's a big title. So welcome to the show, Dan. So nice to have you today.
Thank you, Natasha. It's a pleasure to be here. I suppose you probably want me to start by explaining what this really long title I have is. And as everyone probably knows, the length of your title is inversely proportional to your actual power and authority. But in my case, it's a really important title because it encompasses so many things that we care about here. So the at-risk individuals piece really means that we are responsible for attending to people who are at risk, who might have some special need during a disaster. For example, children or seniors or people with disabilities or people that don't speak English. There's a really wide range of people who fall into the at-risk category. Behavioral health, of course, refers to mental health, which in a disaster context could mean mental health. It could be substance abuse. It could be the stress needs that people have sometimes that emerge immediately after a disaster, including first responders. And then the community resilience piece is the piece that in some ways pulls it all together. And that really has to do with what are the things that we can do to promote resilience in people across the country so that when bad stuff happens, they're going to be able to respond more quickly and hopefully recover sooner. I wonder if I should say something about what ASPR is, the larger organization that we're part of.
Yes, that was the next question I had. And also just give us a little bit more of your own personal history, since I don't have your bio in front of me. Tell us a little bit about yourself personally and how you come to be on this position to begin with.
Okay. Well, let me start there, and then I'll get to what ASPR is. So I'm a clinical psychologist. I happen to be from California, and I was training in California at a time when we had a lot of emergencies. My particular area of focus was on children and trauma. So I did a lot of work in child abuse, child abduction, juvenile delinquency, things like that. And then training in California in the 90s when we had the riots or the civil unrest, whichever term you prefer, the Northridge earthquake, many, many wildfires. There were just a series of events in the state that really caused a lot of trauma that, you know, really had impact on a lot of people. And because I was already there and I had some experience in trauma, I was asked to become part of the response to all of those events. So I've done everything from, you know, being at a Red Cross shelter during an earthquake and, you know, helping people just adjust to being in the shelter as well as the shock of the disaster.
Who in particular asked you to start having?
So I actually was working at a community mental health center mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. And one of their part of their mission really was to provide support to the community for crisis events. So they had a relationship with the Red Cross. So then when the Red Cross needed people to go out, for example, and help with the shelters, they would call on the local community mental health centers to provide staff to do it. And I was one of the people picked to do that. And then because I had been doing that experience in California, when the Oklahoma City bombings happened, the Red Cross asked me if I would be part of the first ever national mental health hotline that they set up to address the mental health needs, not just of Oklahoma City, but of the nation. And basically the way that happened was they needed someone who was an expert in trauma, who was an expert in children, and who spoke Spanish. There was a lot of different needs that they had, and it just so happened I could do all three. So they said, we need to bring Dan out here to help with this. So
how do you come to speak Spanish?
Well, I'm from California, mm-hmm. And I, you know, have spent a lot of time doing work both with the church as well as in other places, doing translation services, etc. I also did a semester in Spain, so I've spent a lot of time both in Spanish-speaking countries as well as, I think, just growing up in Southern California,
okay.
Being exposed to it. My mom was also an ESL teacher, so it came naturally.
Okay. So when you say the church, what church are you referring to?
So it was actually ecumenical churches, but I grew up in the Lutheran church.
Okay, great. That's nice for us to all share our faith backgrounds a little bit on this program. So thank you for that. So give us a little bit then of the mission statement or vision, goals, et cetera, of ASPR in general.
So ASPR is the organization, and ASPR, by the way, stands for Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. So the PR is the important part of the ASPR acronym, Preparedness and Response. And we have been designated by Congress to be the overall lead for coordinating the health aspects of emergency preparedness, response, and recovery. So we coordinate anything that has to do with health or public health or medical aspects of emergencies. This includes everything from, for example, the H1N1 epidemic that we had a couple of years ago. ASPR did a lot of the coordination of activities related to that, all the way up to more severe disasters, for example, Superstorm Sandy, that was just not that long ago, where there were actually some hospitals destroyed and there was a pretty significant need for health personnel. We have 7,000 deployable health workers who can actually go into a community and either set up a temporary hospital facility or can backfill staff at a regular hospital, an existing hospital or clinic. So that's one piece of what we do. And of course, mental health is part of that public health response. So my office really is responsible for making sure that the mental health piece of it is incorporated, as well as I said, these at-risk individuals, making sure that we're paying attention to not just the normal people that we would plan for. By normal, I mean traditional planners often come from a law enforcement or military background, and they're used to focusing on a certain population. But of course, with the civilian population, it's a much, much broader category or a much broader array of people. And so my office's responsibility is really to make sure that we don't forget anybody in our planning efforts.
Okay. So given your vast experience, not only in these government agencies, but also as a practicing clinician yourself, what would you say are kind of the main concerns or topics that you'd like to address on the program today regarding the types of needs that come up during these disasters or things that happen within our communities that we need to be prepared for?
I think that's a great question, and there's so many different ways to answer it. You've used the word prepare, and I think that obviously that's the first and most important thing. I think there are a lot of ways that people can prepare. I think the first thing that's important for people to do is to think about your own family, your own community, your neighbors, all the things that are important to you. Starting with your own family, what are the things that you would need if you had to survive for several days? The food, the water, medicines are particularly important, particularly from a public health perspective. But there are other things that most families need to survive beyond food, water, and medicine. That might include games for children, things to distract them if they get bored. That might include ways to get exercise if you have to stay indoors. There are all kinds of things that are also part of survival. And I think it's important for everyone to have first in their own home something that will enable them to survive, but also to keep as much normalcy as possible. Particularly if you have children, it's really important to maintain the things that give them a sense of normalcy and predictability, even in the middle of a disaster. It's also helpful to practice these things, by the way. You know, I remember when I was a kid, you know, our schools required us to do fire drills, and my parents took that very seriously because you had to sign off on it, you know. So once a semester, my dad would get us up in the middle of the night with the whistle or whatever mechanism that we were using that year and make sure that we all did the fire drill, and he would time us and everything. Those kinds of things aren't bad to do, even though they seem a little bit old-fashioned. I started with your immediate household because I think that's really important. But it's very important to not let your preparedness stop at just your immediate household. One of the things that we know really promotes community resilience is knowing your neighbors and being connected to your community. And I think in general, most people are pretty good at assessing what they would need for themselves and for their family to be prepared. You have to give it a little extra thought if you're really thinking about being perhaps homebound or carbound for several days. But I think most people can do that when they reflect on it. It's that next step that I think we often miss that's really, really important. And that really has to do with your community. Do you know who in your neighborhood maybe has some additional needs? maybe somebody living alone or somebody on a wheelchair or someone who has a healthcare attendant coming in to take care of their needs. And maybe if you live in country where you get frequent snowstorms or fires, it doesn't always have to be the big catastrophic incident like a big earthquake or a terrorist attack or something. There are often smaller events that can really be dangerous for people, particularly a lot of folks need electricity in order to live. It might be because they're in a wheelchair that requires electricity. It might be because they have an oxygen concentrator. For example, I have a nephew with Down syndrome who has pretty significant cardiac problems, and he needs oxygen in order to travel around. So that oxygen concentrator, of course, is electricity dependent. So knowing your neighbors turns out to be really important in promoting community resilience. What do they need? What are some things that you might be able to do for your neighbors in the event that the people that regularly care for them couldn't get there? Because those are also the kinds of things that first off, we want to do as good citizens and good neighbors, but also because in many ways a community's resilience is dependent on its weakest link. And the more that we can take care of those around us, then I think the more resilient the whole community is.
So this concept of emergency preparedness really resonates within the LDS culture. I mean, we have fairs on this stuff. We have callings of, you know, people who are. In fact, my husband currently serves as the emergency preparedness person in our ward. So this is something that we're constantly kind of hearing about within LDS culture. We're really pushing this idea of the 72-hour kit, you know, that everybody should have in their home, and we have concepts such as the 1-year food storage in our home, and you know, so lots of interesting things. And there's a whole kind of like I would say even economic structure of, you know, people who've come up with services or things that people can buy and purchase, you know, for these types of issues. So given that that this is already something that we're pretty good at, what are some ways that we can better collaborate with I think like agencies such as yours within LDS communities, so that we have not only just ourselves that we're depending on, but collaborating, like you're saying, not only with neighbors within our own community, but collaborating as a nation as a whole. So what ideas do you have in that regard?
Natasha, I think you've, again, raised some really, really good issues. And I really applaud exactly what you're saying, that you're part of a community that's really focused on preparedness. I wish that everybody were as focused as the LDS community has been. I think that there are a number of different things. I certainly think that particularly leaders in the health community should be aware of some of the things that are happening at the national level, because they're typically reflected at the state level as well. We do have a national health security strategy, and it talks a lot about a number of different things, including ways to promote community resilience and ways to improve the public health workforce, as well as ways that community members can be involved. We don't use the word bystander anymore, because it's not really, we don't want people to stand by. We want them to be active participants in what's going on in their community, because in most communities, the very first thing or the first people to respond in an incident are neighbors. It's not people who are trained and are coming in from the state capital or from the national capital. It's local people. So we certainly want people to think of national health security as something that everyone is a part of. And in fact, in the current version of the National Health Security Strategy, the first objective is informed, empowered communities. So the emphasis really is how the community itself can be more informed about public health preparedness, as well as be more able to respond. So I think that that's a one thing, again, particularly for leaders in the health field, and I know that some of your listeners are health leaders in their communities, I think it's important to know about this National Health Security Strategy. I think it's also important to know that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is doing a number of things this year to really try to promote preparedness. And I think it's something that local parishes or local congregations could be involved in. It's called the Prepare-a-thon. And actually, I'm not sure when this is going to air, but the first big national action day is April 30th. And then there's another one on September 30th. And there's going to be a lot of information available at FEMA. And people who want for example, a congregation that wants to do a project on this, they're actually encouraged to go to the website and register their event, and then FEMA can publicize it for them, as well as provide them additional materials that could be handed out. They're trying to make things as specific as they can. They don't want it really to be a FEMA project. It really is a national project. So the idea is a lot of the materials are designed that you can put your own logo on them, as well as tailor them in some other ways. I should just mention the website for that is pretty easy to find. It's ready.gov/prepare. So that's READY.gov/prepare. So it's a pretty easy one to find. So I think those are some examples of things that people can get involved in. I think there are a number of things that happen on an ongoing basis. For example, the CERT training that many communities offer. Often it will be through local fire. It might be through the Red Cross. There are a number of different places that the CERT training is offered. Actually, a couple of my employees have done it, and they really do try to make it as you know, as user-friendly and as fun as possible, as well as getting you thinking about how it relates to their community.
Yeah, and I know that there's been, at least in my community, that our local congregations have been involved with CERT training and even providing it in our churches. So that's really exciting. So maybe this is me projecting my own issues on everybody else, which is, I guess, normal. But how do we prepare without becoming religiously anxious or afraid? You know, so in other words, you know, this sense of many times when I grew up listening to these messages, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm going to be faced with some type of disaster in my life. And how am I going to be prepared? Or how do you ever know if you're prepared enough? You know, and so this can really feed on people's anxiety issues if you happen to have that propensity like I do.
Natasha, I don't think you're very unique in that regard. I think, you know, the trick with preparedness is to make people anxious enough that they will do something, but not so anxious that they're unable
that
to
we're
do anything.
Down, right?
Exactly. So we want to a little holy motivation in the right direction, right? But not paralysis. I think a lot of people feel that way. First off, I will say human nature and our own internal resilience is often a lot stronger than we think it is. And it always amazes me how people who don't think that they would be very able to respond in a disaster, how much they do rise to the occasion. I was also a responder at the Pentagon on September 11th, and also I was the lead for mental health for the nation during Katrina. And, you know, I've been through a lot of these. I've lived on a boat in the Gulf during Katrina, and I've lived in shelters, and I've really been with people. And I do want to say it is amazing how resilient people in this nation really are. But having said that, I think there are some things to do that can make you more resilient on a personal basis. I do think preparedness helps a lot and drilling helps a lot. If you and your family know where the extra stores are supplied, if you know who in your neighborhood you want to double check on during a, you know, blizzard or a heat wave or whatever the circumstance in your community is, if you've thought about that through, I think you have a lot less anxiety when the moment hits. I also think the basic call plans, you know, if you have children in school, who's going to go get them? What's the school's policy? Mm-hmm. If the school's on lockdown, how do you find out about that? If the school's on early dismissal, how do you find out about that? Who's going to go? If you have, let's say you live in and I know many LDS members are in the West where there's more frequent earthquakes. Is there a call plan so that if your phones aren't working in your neighborhood, is there a, you know, an Aunt Susie or someone that you can call in a different community that everyone knows, okay, call Aunt Susie if you can't get through on local lines. Whatever, your family should have a plan for those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. The more of those kinds of plans you have, then the more relaxed you're going to be. Well, maybe relaxed isn't the right word, but let's say the less anxious you're going to be.
Sure.
But I do think also there are some things that you can do during an event also to keep your anxiety down. And really, of course, that's a lot of what my office does, looking at the behavioral health aspects of disasters. And I think first off, for those of your listeners who are health responders, there is actually a training called Psychological First Aid, PFA for short. There are a number of different places that you can access psychological first aid. And literally, you can just Google psychological first aid. There are a number of free trainings available. There's one, actually, I just found out, I believe it's in the state of Minnesota, that's only 45 minutes long. Mm. And then there are some that are longer, web-based. You can just kind of run through the slides. The idea of psychological first aid is really just how can you help yourself and those around you just to remain calm and sort of the basics of psychology. It's not counseling. It's not therapy. It's nothing like that. It's just some basic skills that you can use if you're interacting with people who are impacted by a disaster to help keep yourself calm and help keep them calm. And also a little bit of self-checking too, because sometimes sure. In a disaster you think you're doing fine, but you're really not. And so psychological first aid training also gives you a little bit of a way to evaluate how you're doing for yourself and making sure that
and
you're taking care of yourself.
And this is something that's available for the lay public as well,
yeah.
Right? So this would be a good thing for maybe bishops or Relief Society
Absolutely.
Presidents or youth leaders in our church to maybe tap into. And I'll make sure and link to all of these kind of resources that you're mentioning, too.
Perfect. Yeah, I can give you some of the specific websites if you'd like, although, again, a Google search would show a number of them
sure.
right off the bat, and they're all typically free online courses, so it's really easy to do. And I actually think the nice thing about everything we've talked about is you don't have to wait for a catastrophic event to practice psychological first aid skills. Most of us, probably at least once a week, if not once a day, have a little mini crisis
sure.
That will enable us to practice good listening, making sure that the people around you are staying calm, you know. And also the kinds of things that even in the CERT training that you talked about, many of your churches have done, are also skills that you can use on a daily basis. We all have little mini crises, whether it's, you know, an early school closing or maybe a, you know, someone slips and falls, you know, on the sidewalk. Or, I mean, mini crises occur all the time. And I think the more that we can practice the kinds of skills we're talking about for disaster preparedness when little mini crises happen, then when the bigger things happen, getting back to your point earlier, you're just less anxious because you've kind of drilled it and you've thought about it already. I think the thing that concerns people the most about natural disasters and big events is this sense of everything being unpredictable and unknown. But in fact, if you've been thinking about it and planning for it, that eliminates a lot of the anxiety.
Yeah, I think you're kind of speaking to this idea of emotional resiliency. So let's delve into a little bit more. I mean, what can a community expect from a mental health perspective from those who have survived some type of either natural disaster or trauma or, you know, these examples that you're giving? What are the common responses and even the spectrum of responses? Like some people deal with trauma very differently than others.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. First off, I want to say really big events are upsetting. I mean, I would never say don't expect people to be upset. But as you said, there's going to be a full range. I think of, again, many of the things that I've responded to. You see a really wide range of responses among people that again, sort of anything goes in the first couple of days. Some people might be quite numb. Some people might be quite emotional, tearful. Again, it depends on the nature of the event. I think it becomes a concern if you see extreme events and there are extreme responses stretching out for many, many days. So I want to say right off the bat, like kind of in the first few hours or days after an event, you're going to see a lot of different kinds of responses. And that's not necessarily cause for worry. So what are those kinds of responses that you might see? Well, let's start with children, because I think people are often most concerned about how children will respond. And I am a child psychologist, so I love talking about children. I think the typical responses that you see in children are often really sort of under the label of regression, I guess, for lack of a better word. For example, you might have a 3 or 4-year-old that maybe starts having accidents again, or not being able to sleep through, by accidents, I mean, you know, in the toilet,
sure.
by not being able to sleep through the night, sucking their thumb, you know, things that sort of going back to older behaviors that they had when they were younger. You often see with children when they're upset. Actually, when they're upset, even if it's not a disaster, you sometimes see that. And
right.
I think even more so.
Classic one is the birth of a new baby.
Exactly. Birth of a new baby can do that. Starting a new school. All of those things that are upsetting to kids, the kind of reactions you see,
sure.
You often will see in a disaster. I think the other things that you often might see in people that, again, if they extend for a longer period of time would be of concern, would be, you know, changes in sleeping habits. People with children as well as adults suddenly sleeping a lot more or a lot less than they used to. Changes in eating habits, again, eating more or less than they used to. More irritability. I think often during when you're in the middle of responding to a crisis, people sometimes don't realize how affected they really are. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes can lead to irritability, sometimes to poor problem solving, and also sometimes to some insensitivity to people around you because you're so focused on your own needs and what's going on that you may not be sensitive to what's going on around you. Obviously, things like sadness, anxiety, depression, all of those things are things that you might see. Again, in the initial phase, anger, sadness, anxiety, or even kind of a numbness would not be unusual. And I think particularly for the faith community, also we'll see, you know, people really having questions about, you know, whether God is good or not. And you know, what is the meaning of this? And is there some higher purpose that's being served here or some lesson that I'm supposed to be learning? And none of those are necessarily bad questions to ask. I mean, certainly you want to be sensitive that it doesn't produce sort of a secondary trauma by people, you know, having a crisis of faith or a crisis of sort of their belief in a good God or in a good world. So I think those are things, for example, that clergy might want to be thinking about. But all of those are, in the initial phases, shouldn't be cause for concern. I think anybody, I mean, again, I was, you know, I was at the Pentagon when it was still on fire and they were still pulling out, you know, remains. And you certainly do see all this range of responses. And I wouldn't say anybody necessarily needs any kind of counseling or trauma care because they're asking those questions or they're sad or they're numb or they're not sleeping in those first couple of days. We should be monitoring that, of course, and we should be sensitive to encouraging people to sleep and to, you know, to take care of themselves. But again, in the first few days or even sometimes weeks, depending on how big the event is, you want to understand that that's a process that people go through. I think, though, if you find it continuing over time, if, you know, many days or weeks, again, depending on how big the event was, or months after the event, people are still asking those same questions, expressing the same level of anger or anxiety or fear or depression, then I think that's when it's time to say, okay, well, you know, maybe this person might need a little bit more support. And that could be from their clergy person, that could be from a professional, or it might even just be a good heart-to-heart talk with someone that you trust and can confide in. But I think the emphasis here is really that people have pretty extreme reactions often at the very beginning phase of an emergency, but most people on their own, through their own coping skills, through the people that they always have loved and relied on and been able to talk to, usually work those things out relatively quickly. Again, we are pretty resilient folks, mm-hmm. and the more prepared we can be, of course, the more resilient we'll be.
Right, we're made to adapt. I'm really glad you brought up kiddos. In my neck of the woods, living in Wichita, Kansas, some of the disasters that we've had affect us are obviously tornadoes, and one in particular in Joplin a few years mm-hmm. ago that actually destroyed an entire church of ours. And lots of our members were affected by their homes being destroyed and things of that nature. So one thing I wanted to point out was understanding that kids will often play out the trauma, right? So lots of kids playing tornado, mm-hmm. you know, as far and not being concerned or scared that your kid maybe is doing some of that play therapy per se, you know, as far as their own coping through some of these things that have been scary for them. So I would assume you would agree with that.
And yeah, absolutely. And again, I think it's, I mean, children do use play, I think, sometimes as a way to sort of work out. Children often don't have the vocabulary, particularly very young children, don't have the vocabulary to say, "Mommy, I'm feeling stressed and anxious about the fact that we just survived a tornado."
Right.
And so sometimes playing it is sort of their way of retelling the story in the way that adults would do, you know, over a beverage.
Over hot chocolate.
exactly. Over a non-caffeinated beverage. But The thing that again, it's all a matter of degree, and I think the best judge of that is usually the parent themselves. You know, gauging is the play in isolation or is the play in conjunction with other things. So if your child is acting out tornadoes in play, but otherwise doesn't really seem to be particularly impacted, that wouldn't concern me. But if you have a child who's not sleeping or doesn't want to go out with friends the way they used to or is in other ways different and also is playing tornado a lot with, you know, their Barbies or their Hot Wheels or whatever, then I think that's where, you know, always I think it's really important to look at the whole child or the whole adult for that matter. Sure. It could be a spouse or a colleague that we were talking about here too. Hopefully they aren't playing tornado, but,
right.
You know, it, you know, we should never overinterpret one thing, but if you see it in the context of several things, then I think that's when it becomes concerning. And I don't at all on this show want to say, oh, everything, if you're concerned, you should go find a professional and talk to that person, because that isn't necessarily always what you need to do, although certainly I think people should be aware that there are, you know, mental health professionals that are trained in trauma and PTSD and disaster response, who can be really helpful. But I think that there are other ways that you can be helpful too. And I actually think some of the skills that you would learn, for example, in the psychological first aid, et cetera, give you at least a way to talk to people about, oh, so it seems like you've been really upset since the tornado. And, you know, would you like to talk about that? I mean, it doesn't have to be a professional. I think friends and community members can serve that too. And they also can judge, if the person isn't able to judge for themselves, whether or not, you know, have you considered maybe talking to your pastor or talking to a professional about this?
Sure. Yeah, it seems like frequency of symptoms and longevity is kind of what you're referring
exactly.
to as far as, like, knowing how affected somebody
right.
is. And I think understanding the physiological aspects of trauma as well, you know, just that adrenaline's coursing through your body and that has an effect, you know, and you may go into shock at first, like you mentioned, but later it may come back as far as, oh, now I can process this. And exactly. why am I having a panic attack 2 weeks after the event? And that might be actually a somewhat normal thing for your body to be doing.
Exactly.
Okay. I really appreciated you bringing up this idea of anger or drawing closer to God, which I think are two spectrums of a very, quote-unquote, normal way of dealing with things. I think that people oftentimes in trauma get angry with God or upset or feel betrayed by God. And then there's others who respond by feeling closer to God or relying on God. And the importance, I think, as a community to not be judgmental of mm-hmm. either response. Is that something that you could speak to a little bit more of? Or?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, and I think you've said it nicely. There's actually, in the research, starting to be a lot of studies on positive effects of disaster and how people find positive meaning from disasters. And it's really interesting, and there actually is a pretty large subset of people impacted by disasters who afterwards actually find more meaning, sort of in a spiritual sense, and sometimes in a more communitarian sense as well, from disasters. So I certainly think there are a lot of people, again, who actually, the disaster itself isn't positive, and I don't want to suggest that it is, but who find positive meaning from it. As you said, though, there are also people who often, you know, really find that it makes them question their faith system and their belief system. And I think that those are also sort of equally, I don't want to say necessarily equally common, but certainly things that you would see as well. So you're right. You do see the full spectrum. And again, I think often over time that is going to lessen. Although hopefully the positive meaning won't lessen. Hopefully mm-hmm. that will continue for people because it, I think, really helps people cope. I think the overall message for me, I think if I could boil it down, would really be that in the initial phases of a disaster, you will see a range of responses from numbness to business as usual to extreme anger to people finding meaning to people whose whole kind of body system as well as their emotional, spiritual system will be very upset. That range is really quite broad. And in those early phases, people probably shouldn't be too alarmed by that, as long as people are obviously taking care of their basic needs. I mean, if you have someone who's refusing to eat or not sleeping at all, that's something that you need to be attentive to right away, because mm-hmm. it has really huge impacts, obviously. But then I think over time, most people really are more resilient than they give themselves credit for, and they do really return to some level of normalcy relatively quickly. But there are some people who are going to need a little extra support to return to normal. That support might be through their family, through their community, through their clergy, or through a mental health professional. And then later on, there's going to be a much, much smaller set of people who really have a more extreme reaction. And these are often the people who were perhaps closest to the event. Maybe they lost a loved one. Maybe their life or property actually, if not, were either severely damaged or at least threatened. Those folks may have, you know, more impact, and they may need more support. I do want to say that if mental health counseling ends up being indicated and appropriate, we really have very, very, very good treatments that are not medication for PTSD, for example, and anxiety-related disorders. PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a very small percentage of people who will get PTSD after an event, depending, of course, on the event. You know, 9/11 it had probably higher rates than for example, a severe winter storm or something would have. Mm-hmm. But we do have good treatments for that. So I would say even for people who are having an extreme reaction, we should still be hopeful, because I actually think we're really good at treating PTSD if it can be identified. So even people with the most extreme reaction, I think we can help them access their coping and their strengths inside themselves. It might take a little extra support and assistance, perhaps from a professional, to do that. But I think our message here should be hopeful that right. There's going to be a huge range of responses, but that most people really will start to recover on their own or with minimal support. But even people who need a lot of extra support, there's support out there, and it's usually pretty good.
Yeah, so there's cognitive means. There's, you mentioned possibility of medication that's not always needed, obviously. There's just all kinds of different forms of treatment out there, that group therapies, things mm-hmm. of that nature, that can be very useful. So going back to kind of the collaborative piece of this, if you could, you know, I guess wave your magic wand and develop the relationship that you'd like to have with, you know, the Mormon community, as far as really truly being partners in these types of efforts, what are some things that you would like to see happen within our congregations or within our communications with your agency, or any other ideas that you might have?
I think that's a great question. And I think that increasingly a lot of major denominations have formed committees or coalitions that focus on health and healthcare. And I think for my agency's perspective, that's probably would be the easiest linkage, because I think that we really, obviously, we're the Department of Health and Human Services. We're sure. going to focus on the health aspects. And I think that those linkages can be really powerful. One of the things, for example, that we're focusing on right now is building coalitions for healthcare professionals, which could include usually hospitals or centers, obviously, for healthcare professionals, but also clinics, people who serve specific populations. So we're funding communities to build coalitions across the country specifically for the purpose of health preparedness. So there's certainly at least one in every state, and in most states far more than one. And I think that might be an example of a way that people could engage, is to find their local healthcare coalition, so that your health providers know who are the folks who are really getting together and talking about preparedness. Every community also is doing some kind of risk assessment. Every community has an emergency management. It might be called their emergency management authority. It might be called their emergency planner. You know, it's each city or county or state might have a slightly different title. But everybody's got one. And I think to the degree that people can find out who in their community is doing the planning, increasingly at HHS and at FEMA, there is an emphasis on what we call whole community planning, which really is how do we get everybody involved and engaged in planning. I think the days of an emergency management authority that, you know, sits in a room somewhere and does all the planning for the community are long gone. Mm-hmm. And I think really we're now at the place where we want the whole community involved. In the disability community, there's a saying, nothing about us without us. Mm-hmm. They don't want people planning for them. And I think really that that's a saying that we should apply to every community, whether it's a community based on faith, whether it's a community based on neighborhood, whether it's a community based on family connections, whether school, whatever. We're all members of many communities. And I think this whole community approach that we're really trying to espouse wants to take that into account. So I would really encourage people to find out, particularly the leaders of congregations, to find out who does this planning in your community and how can we be involved. I think this preparathon that I talked about earlier is a kind of natural opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because there'll be these two action days. There'll be a fair amount of publicity, from USA Today and CNN to hopefully local news stations, et cetera. I think these kind of create just natural opportunities for doing bulletin inserts, for doing other things that can get people talking about it. And then I think once you get people talking about it, then it becomes easier to go to your local city planners or county planners and say, we've got 20 people in our congregation that would like to take a CERT course or would like to volunteer or be engaged in some way. And I think that most community leaders would be very, very open to that. They want people to be prepared.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And I think that there's lots of opportunities for us to be involved with our, like I said, I think we have a lot of strengths within the Mormon population as far as emergency preparedness, but this reaching out to others in our community is such an important piece of that. Okay, so we're kind of getting to the end of the questions I had prepared, but are there any topics or issues that maybe I haven't thought to ask you about or haven't brought up that you feel important to include in this conversation?
I think you've asked a lot of great questions, and I hope I haven't rambled too much in answering them. I guess if I could say anything, I just think that knowing your neighbor, and I think this has always been really a strength of the LDS community, is the sense of neighbor and the sense of community. But I really think, let me give an example. Some of you may be familiar with, or some of your listeners may be familiar with the Village model. It's focused primarily on connecting seniors and supporting seniors in particularly seniors who are aging in place in their communities. So folks who may in the past have gone to live with a family member or even gone to a senior community are staying in their homes now. But as they're aging and their ability level is changing, of course, their house and their neighborhood is not. And so they have more needs. So these villages are popping up all over the country. And there's one right here on Capitol Hill where we're doing this recording. And one of the things that the Capitol Hill Village has done is they've developed a relationship with their local Boy Scout troop. So the Boy Scouts have assigned to them all the streets and all the houses where seniors live who might need assistance. And the seniors identify what assistance they'd need. And so these scouts know every time we have a snowstorm, which in Washington, D.C. this year has been at least once a week for the last 3 or 4 months,
sure,
which is kind of crazy for us. But in many, communities in the Mountain West especially is not so unusual. And they're assigned. So each scout knows what house he's to go to and shovel snow and shovel a sidewalk or whatever his assignment is. So they actually have it all planned in advance. This is not rocket science, having Boy Scout troops sign up to shovel sidewalks in the snow. But it's just a small piece of or a small example of the kind of thing that can be done when you connect different parts of a community that serve different people. When you start to connect them together, I don't know that in the past people would have necessarily thought of let's connect Boy Scouts with an aging-in-place community organization. But by doing it, that's disaster preparedness, right? That's community resilience because now you don't have to worry about frail seniors shoveling sidewalks. And as you know, in this community, we're talking about, brick sidewalks and every house has multiple steps going in. So, bricks are a little bit harder to shovel because they're uneven. Steps are a little bit harder to shovel. I mean, there's all these complexities that for a frail senior could be really hard.
Sure.
But for a Boy Scout hopefully won't be too challenging. I think it's an example of the kind of thing that we can do to sort of break down the old silos and get communities really working together at the local level to think about who in my community has a need, how can I help to meet that need, or how can I connect that person to someone who can help meet that need so that when bad things happen, that no one in our community is going to get forgotten. No one in our community is going to get left behind because we didn't think about their needs. That would be, I think, my message is how can we connect people together? And then we're going to promote wellness. I mean, health and human services, we're all about health, right? But if we can do that kind of basic preparedness, then I think we will promote health. And the more prepared we are, the less mental health consequences we're going to have in the first place, right? Because if people are prepared and they're helping one another, there's going to be less significant mental health impact in the long term. There'll still be some. And we've talked a little bit about some of the ways to recognize that and to address it. But really right now, I think our focus should always be on promoting resilience. How can we help people be resilient so that they're prepared when something bad happens, that they're going to recover more quickly, and presumably they'll be recovering in the context of a community that's going to support them and help them recover.
Well, I love the example of the Boy Scouts because obviously in the LDS community, we have a lot of Boy Scouts and we also have a lot of young women, you know, that are working towards like personal progress goals, which is kind of a similar program to the Boy Scout program. And so there's lots of opportunities regardless of age to serve, which is, again, a huge principle of the Mormon Church and so important to us to live by these principles of serving each other and love our neighbor and all these, you know, beautiful teachings from Christ that have to do with so many of the principles that you're speaking of. Thank you so much, Dan, for your time and for being willing to spend some time with me today and talk about such important concepts. And we'll welcome you back anytime you want to come back and talk more about these issues. So thanks again for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee, Jesus saved.